ending of another day together. Just reflecting on how it's been for us and how it is. Tanisha and I have been touched and we feel so much that people have given themselves to this space, to this practice, with a lot of sincerity. So there have been very good results. Sincerity of listening, sincerity of applying these teachings to our own body, to our own mind. Special time that we've set aside. Made a lot of input, heard a lot of different aspects of the teaching. Some of which I'm sure ring some bells, some of which resonates, some of which doesn't seem to really apply. Encourage everyone not to worry about what doesn't seem to resonate, to let that go. If something seems to connect or resonate, to trust that on some level it goes in. I realize in 26 years, it's been about 26 years ago right now that I first encountered the teachings of the Buddha in this life. And I realize there has been it's not turned out exactly the way I thought. Disillusion, but not a bad disillusion. I feel a good disillusion. I get very inspired. And I heard the teachings and did my first retreat. I think the first 3 days was just hell. Absolute hell. And we didn't get much instruction, but the teacher just said, watch the breath. And so being obedient, I tried and failed and tried and failed and tried and failed and tried and failed and then had a experience of actually being present. I remember one moment. It was in the countryside of England, in before I became a monk, this was part of my inspiration that led me off to Thailand. I've been practicing for a few days with a lot of confusion, but then I remember being peaceful, being outside in front of a bush. Now, ordinarily, in terms of my level of being interested in things, I was interested in philosophy, papers, exams, getting grades, winning things, happiness, and bushes didn't figure high up. Now, of course, I wasn't thinking at the time of the burning bush. That wasn't in my mind, but it was just a bush. In fact, in America, a bush can even kind of be a derogatory term. Like in sports, you can talk about bush league. It means it's just kind of. Of course, now we have a president. I gotta be careful. Gotta be careful about that. But I wasn't all psyched up about being standing by a bush. I was just outside. And I experienced for the first time, usually I would just kind of scan, is this important? Go to the next thing, go to the next thing. My life made up of important things, not important. I was just standing there. I realized it was early in the morning. There was lots of little dewdrops on the bush, and the light was such that it was just like filled with diamonds. And it was, and I was just standing, appreciating, not going anywhere, just appreciating the beauty of just standing, looking at the bush. For the first time, I really sensed the possibility from within the heart of learning to enjoy being, just being here and seeing the beauty, just the beauty of things. So I kept working on the retreat, and then I did the math. Calculate. You can do that in 10 days. Let me just think. 10 days, that's 3 10-day periods in a month, 12 months in a year. 1 year, I should be able to crack this enlightenment business. 2 years at the most. Might run into a few obstacles. Because I figured it just up and away. And I think in my early years, there were true revelations. It is the nature of awareness to reveal to us, to reveal the underlying beauty of our own being, the underlying beauty of this cosmos. All the possibilities. But when I say disillusioned, what I needed to do is, because I ran into obstacles, is to let go of the illusion that it's just kind of, you know, up and away. That it is a gradual and in a way an awesome undertaking to little by little open up to our being, to our fellow beings, to the world. The Buddha once gave a talk to that he didn't send out invitations to. He didn't announce I'm giving a talk tonight. But it was a full moon night, the full moon of February. And 1,250 of his enlightened disciples all thought at the same time, let's go be with the Buddha tomorrow. And so they all showed up without invitations. They all congregated. That was a pretty special congregation. It's just not 1,250 of anybody. It's 1,250 of those who are peaceful, truly peaceful beings. Awesome assembly. So when the Buddha gave a talk, so you'd think, well, see Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, oh, Kitty Searle's going to pull out the real deep stuff from tonight. And he's talking about the talk that the Buddha gave to 1,250 enlightened disciples. And yet the simplicity of the talk amazing and relates to this illusion I'm talking about in a positive sense, the letting go of illusions, the becoming more realistic, not pessimistic, realistic. The first part of the Buddha's talk was Panti Paramanta Bodhitika Nibbanam Paramanta Buddha. Memorize that a little bit, love just the sound of the Pali. And it's the ultimate practice, he says, and you think, all right, now we're getting to it. The ultimate practice for overcoming that which is harmful, for the burning up of all those states which are different, the ultimate practice is patience. Nibbanam paramang vadanti buddha. Nibbana, the coolness of our true nature. Clarity of our true nature, the freedom of our true nature is the ultimate state. And then he went on in a very simple teaching which now has been passed down over the centuries, which we reflect in our monastic traditions as the Owada Parimokkha, as the laying out of the path that takes us out of the wilderness. Bondage to freedom, similar to the great story of in the Bible of Eden leaving bondage of Egypt, having a vision of the promised land, having a vision of the possibility of something free than slavery, but having to move through the desert, wander through the desert to actually eventually find that which is truly sacred, that which is truly peaceful, to find home, to find one's way to one's true home. So the Buddha went on to give the essence of this path from bondage to home. And in the Pali language that the Buddha spoke, it sounds like this. Sabba pappassa akaranam kusala suppa sampata sajitta pariyodapanam etam buddhana sasana. Very simple, very short. The whole path is right there. Sabba pappassa akaranam. To learn to recognize that which is harmful. Pappassa. That which is harmful. That which harms ourselves. That which harms others. Karana, to learn to recognize it and learning not to act on it. To learn to see within us and around us that which really we then learn to know is not good. Learning to be restrained in terms of not acting on it, but learning to know it. Kusala Supa Sampada means to learn to recognize that which is wholesome, that which is healing, that which is good. Upasampada means to learn to lift that up, to make much of it, to cultivate it, that we've been doing. So citta pariyodhaka. The heart, our own heart, this heart, pariyodhaka, to learn to purify the heart. Etam buddhana sasana, this is the teaching of all Buddhas. To learn to recognize that which is harmful, not to do that. That which is good and wholesome, to learn to lift that up, make much of that in our lives, to recognize that, to purify the heart. This is the teaching of all the Buddhas. And that of all these practices, the ultimate practice for overcoming, purifying that which is obstructing, is patience. And I think what I didn't really have a sense for. I mean, my enthusiasm was wonderful when I started, and that enthusiasm is good. It's useful, and there's been quite a few people who've had lovely insights on this retreat. Possibility of the mind being spacious, the mind being peaceful, the mind being free. And then feeling frustrated then when an old tendency comes back, the doubt, the worry, or the sense of being scattered. Worry that thinks, gosh, did I just imagine that? Is it just something I created in the mind? Is it really real? And the sorrow, the sense of not being able to do it. Each of us has our own patterns, our own tendencies. It would be nice if we could just, once we've seen it once, then that's it. There was one very, very powerful teacher that was quite, I think in many ways, quite wise, but he said something that I think he was wrong. Anyway, he used to say, when you've seen it one time, then you're done with it. With it. Didn't work for me that way. And I've certainly noticed every other person I've ever trained with in the monastery did. My teacher, who is the wisest person I ever met, didn't work that way. So maybe somebody worked that way. But so many beings that we have an opportunity, we have moments of real clear seeing, maybe moments where we have some presence of mind, some collectedness. And we recognize the worry. It's a wonderful insight to, for a change, not be hijacked by the worry, but to see the worry, to recognize it, to sense it, but then not get tangled in it. A moment of real perspective, a moment of freedom. Or to recognize the self-hatred. Something that comes into the mind that just shames us, puts us down unnecessarily. About something that is not even bad. Sometimes the mind can undermine us. And that we can then have a moment of recognition. That doesn't necessarily mean that we'll never get fooled by it again, never get knocked over by it again. It doesn't mean to say it wasn't a true insight, you know, that the insight that we had wasn't a true insight. But some things have karmic force, that moment. think Tanisha one night or one morning was speaking about the like the big rains in Africa when they fall. When rains fall, then water tends to follow grooves, and then a little groove becomes a little stream bed. A little stream bed becomes a ravine. A ravine then becomes a kind of what in Africa is called a donga, a place where the energy can have a tendency to flow. And some of our habits are not so deep-rooted. Some of our habits are ancient. The Buddha described them sometimes as some habits are like lines drawn in the water. You draw a line in the water and there's a little ripple there, but then quickly it smooths over. Some of our habits are like lines drawn in the sand, like on the beach. There's a tendency there. We can recognize it, but not too much of the waves flowing in and out, and then the traces are gone. Some of our habits aren't that deep-rooted. They're easier to let go of. Some of our habits are like lines etched in stone. They're old conditioned tendencies. It's easy for the stream of thought, the stream of habit, to just follow them. And those are the habits that sometimes require a lot of patience. I think for a long time then I would get very discouraged when I'd have moments of real clarity, moments of real beauty, times of real beauty, freedom. I would look and there's nothing in the heart bothering me. I'd think, ah, we're done. And then feeling, so discouraged when an old tendency would come back. Then if one's not careful, one can then just think, oh gosh, I'm lost in this one. But the disillusionment, the usefulness of the disillusionment is realizing that's the way it unfolds. Some habits, because of their momentum, they will keep reappearing. That's just their nature. Unless we, with patience, learn to patiently allow them to run their course without getting discouraged, without just assuming, oh, that means, without having to make a definition to call ourselves me with the big worry habit, or me with the big anger habit, or me with the big this habit. Yes, we can recognize what's there, but rather than attaching to that limited definition of ourself, we can allow that to become our teacher. That's what our teacher encouraged us, that these difficult areas in our lives, which seem to be obstructions, which can really distress us when they come back, encourage them to change our perception of them from problems to teachers, that which are sharpening stones. He also described them as a stone that allows our sword of wisdom to become sharp. It appears, and we there's friction. Part of us doesn't want it, doesn't want the discouragement, doesn't want the sickness, doesn't want the sense of loneliness, doesn't want the feeling victimized by our desires, doesn't want the difficult temper. But these recurring tendencies, these recurring habits, if we are wise, patient, they can be that which wakes us up, that which spurs us on to being very mindful, very patient. told some of you during our individual talks how even the Buddha himself had to still hear different tendencies, even after he was enlightened. But he didn't make a problem of it. But even for 7 years after the Buddha was enlightened, Mara, or the force of confusion, the force that causes doubt, the force of delusion, what in Judaism might be called the hasetan, the doubter, the tempter, used to follow the Buddha around, whisper in his ear, "Don't you miss your family? Who are you fooling living out here in the forest all by yourself? Admit it. Go back and enjoy yourself. You can do much more good back there." But he would just hear these voices and turn and just say, "I know you. I know that." He didn't try to fight. Mara didn't try to throw a counter mantra to cut Mara in half. He just recognized. And for some of us, when we leave this retreat, even on the retreat, when we go home with some of these old friends or old difficulties arise in our lives, and I just hope we can be disillusioned in a good way and remember this teaching the Buddha gave, that an ultimate practice is being patient. An ultimate practice is not taking refuge in trying to get rid of things, but letting our refuge be in knowing how things are, rather than getting so discouraged when the familiar doubt, or the illness, or the anxiety, or the fear comes, to be able to actually, rather than hate it, to I know you. Or even if that might be too arrogant to say, "Oh, hi, I need to get to know you better." Which is the middle way between believing and getting lost in, or rejecting and trying to deny or to crush. So this is not an exciting teaching. This is the last thing, probably, when I was a kid, when my patience was, when my mom would say, "Patience is a virtue." I'm going to pull my hair out. And, you know, I think of my mom now with gratitude. But, you know, it is not something exciting to hear. Patience is a virtue. But, you know, the truth is, patience is and let's purify our patience, too. There's one kind of patience that's just tapping our foot. "All right, I've been patient now for 5 minutes. Supposed to go now." That's a kind of patience. That's the beginning of patience. But to really get a feeling for the willingness. And we've been practicing this today because all these different virtues have different names, but they all come out of one heart. You know, we talk about little finger, fourth finger, third finger, index finger, thumb, look. They're part of a hand, part of a body, they're part of the Dhamma, they're part of the cosmos. You can talk about different aspects, but really it's all part of a unity. Like today, our kindness practice, our metta practice, is very much linked in. It's very unified with patience. The willingness to welcome and be with that which we don't want to be with, to keep making space for, to keep opening to. More pure patience than just, "All right, I'll be patient with you, but then you have to go 10 seconds, a minute." But to really practice relaxing with, to practice being okay with hanging out with that which is not easy to be with. And we can practice in little ways. practicing patience in driving. Patience with a body that doesn't feel so good. Patience with the 100th time when we find ourselves in a mood we don't want to be in. We don't want to be anxious. We don't want to be caught up in thoughts that we don't think we should be caught up in. But we can say, this is how it is. This beautiful disillusionment of reality. We can let go of just pretending, and really allow this to be a teacher, allow this to soften our heart, to deepen our capacity to be with our life. In my own life, this particular teaching was offered to me very graphically by my teacher Ajahn Chah. So I remember him with gratitude. And if you think teachers just have it easy, you think, oh, it's easy for them to say, they get enlightened and then go around in bliss all the time and then just tell us to be patient. Our teacher was incredibly patient. So many, before he died, he had over 100 monasteries. Tens of thousands of people that looked to him. And yet even the last 10 years of his life, he was very unwell. He was paralyzed. So to think that, we're not the only ones who have to practice being patient. But I remember once I'd been got all inspired in my early monastic years, and then I was decided that I went to Thailand, that I needed to practice harder. The other Westerners were talking too much, and I needed to go to the monastery where nobody spoke English, where it was proper deep meditation. And it's fair enough. So then I started picking up the most difficult practices, and I heard about one teacher that was tougher. Another one of Ajahn Chah's Thai disciples. Tougher. Remember, I used to be a wrestler, so this is how my mind worked. And so I was doing practices of like 3 months I didn't lie down, set up, and so I slept sitting up, and I did some different fasting, which wasn't even that recommended by the Buddha, but I thought I had to do something more difficult. And went off to this tougher monastery. Then, surprise, I started getting sick. And, I had diarrhea for about 6 months, and which I thought, well, you can handle that. But then I started imagining, I kept feeling like I was getting fatter and fatter because my stomach was getting bigger. And so I felt actually fat. I felt huge. And you only ate one meal a day, and your food was sticky rice. It's called glutinous rice. It's like a cannonball. Like that. And that you have one shot at it. And this particular monk at the tough monastery, who wasn't following ordinary Buddhist guidelines, but anyway, this was, he thought we were wasting time in unnecessary pleasures at the meal. So they just got electricity in this part of Thailand, so he had a new toy. He had a buzzer. So usually in the monastery, the senior monk takes the first bite. And the other monks, of course, you don't want to show that you're hungry, so no one's looking at it. But out of the side of your eye, you notice when the first monk has eaten, and then the next monk slowly, mindfully takes a bite. Of course, no one looks very interested. But everybody's interested in the next month, guys, the next month. So usually it's like that. There's this ritual, the first month, second month, third month, and then these guys at the end of the line, you know, they find them, then everybody eats, and Ajahn Chah let people take their time eating. This particular monk he decided that was entirely too indulgent. So he had electricity, and he had a buzzer. So he decided that once he hit the buzzer, then everybody starts at the same time. So I go to this monastery, didn't know how it all worked, and I noticed the buzzer rang, and then everybody starts going like this. And usually you eat with one hand, but here, these guys were eating with two. They were coming in like that. And I'm thinking, man, and then after a while, I realized when he jumps off the platform, anybody who still eats, I mean, that's like the whole world is looking at you like, if you want to be greedy, fine. But, you know, like, it's very clear that's when you stop. And so now I thought, well, I can get in here with the best of them. Because then you have to scan the bowl quickly and find the best bits and go after those. And while this one's coming up, the other one's already scanning. Just scanning to get down there. Chewing is out. Chewing is out. Just one continuous swallow. So then at the end of that time, one feels like a beached whale. You crawl back to your hut and vow never to eat again. And then the next day, 24 hours later, you're starving. And then the buzzer rings. Anyway, I was convinced I was getting fat, but the other monks in Taiwan were telling me, oh, how are you? I mean, you're looking pretty thin. I'm saying, thin? I got this huge belly. I was losing weight. I was like a skeleton. But I couldn't see it. I think I had anorexia, but I felt huge. So anyway, then one day I got bit by a centipede, which is the most painful sting in the forest. It's an insect about that long, about that wide, 100 legs with pinchers. And I was in the shed where you make your clothes a certain color, your robes. But it's, in English, it's a pun. It's called the dyeing shed, where you dye your robes to color. But dying also means the place where you die. So the two words mean the same thing. So I was in the dying shed doing my robes, and then underneath one of the mats, this insect bit me. And then the other monk's eyes kind of got huge. And they went, da-cop! And they shook it off, and then they started doing mantras and blowing on it and telling everybody else, and then they all steamed my hand and threw stuff on it and spit on it. Everybody had a different healing. And then meanwhile, this unbelievable pain starts moving. This fire starts moving up, and I'm just kind of rocking and in pain. And then as a kid, I was allergic to stings, and I'm thinking, what's going to happen when this thing gets to here? And it's kind of moving up, and then all night long, I'm sitting in the hall moaning because it's painful. And I didn't die, but my hand was swelled up for 3 weeks, and then I started urinating blood. And so then the tough monk, who actually, I mean, he's actually very sweet, he's died now, but I mean, he started worrying because he didn't want the Westerner to die in his monastery. And so, you know, usually he was actually really tough and wanted us to work hard, but he actually had quite a soft heart. And he didn't want me dying in the monastery. And so he said, we got to get this guy to a hospital. And so they took me back to the had a whole experience in the hospital, and I couldn't quite work out what was going on. But then from a period of my practice where I had been so inspired, I went into a kind of dark period of practice, and I got really... So I finally got over that particular illness. I was still sick. I didn't know it, but I had typhoid in my blood. You know, typhoid? Typhoid fever. Typhoid. So later I was to come down with typhoid fever and almost die, but that didn't come for another maybe month or so. So they sent me back to the Western Monastery. And I was practicing with everyone. And I was still sick, but we didn't really know it. But I just noticed I was just getting discouraged. And it just seemed impossible. I felt so greedy. I hated myself because every day I would be so hungry. And then once you get in the habit of eating fast, it's hard to let go of. And I felt lustful. I felt unworthy of the offerings that people were giving me. And then I had spent my life winning championships, winning awards, and getting your hand lifted up. And in the monastery, everybody's just looks the same. On the line there, you're sitting there at your place, you look up the line, and there's just bald heads. Rogues and bald heads. You look down the line, more bald heads. You look into the future and you think, my future, just another bald head. You know, and you look down and I'm getting fatter every day. Just greedy. You know, so, you know, I told the abbot of the monastery, I said, I think I need to talk to Ajahn Chah. So his name is Prabhakara. He was, used to be a Vietnam helicopter pilot. Left the army. Good monk, spoke Laotian and Thai fluently, and was a good friend. So he said, okay, Kisara, let's go see Ajahn Chah. So he took me to see Ajahn Chah, and I was in a state where I felt like I just couldn't imagine smiling or laughing again. It was just one of these dark places. So Ajahn Chah is sitting in his chair, and said, well, what is it? And I said, well, Ajahn Chah, I really feel like I can't imagine, it's hard to imagine smiling again or laughing again. I said, you know, I just feel quite discouraged. So he asked me about how things were going. And then he told two stories, which I'll briefly tell. To this day, I still feel very grateful for the stories. He said, Kittisalo, or he said my name, Kittisalo. They don't say the R's so much in Thai, Kittisalo. He says, you remind me of a chipmunk. It's like a squirrel. You know, a squirrel, a little animal that climbs the trees. Yeah. And but there's one kind that can jump. Jump to the different, so in America you call it a chipmunk. It's a little smaller than a squirrel. It's very similar to a squirrel. He said, you remind me of a chipmunk. And then Babakwa, who's translating, said, he says, you remind him of a chipmunk. So he says, now this chipmunk was a baby, and it had a mother. Now its mother could climb up the tree and then jump to this branch and jump to that branch and do all kind of acrobatics. And the baby looked up at the mother and said, ooh, I'd like to be like that. And so the baby runs up the tree and then jumps. And then the word in Thai is dog. And Ajahn Chah said dog. So Prabhakara said, oh, the baby, the mother, dog, which means it falls down. So the chipmunk falls down. Dog means fall down. And chipmunk's upset. And the mother says, son, you need to go to school. So this chipmunk goes to school and it studies. It starts to learn things. Now it's learned a few more things, and so it runs up and it jumps, and it can jump to the branch. And then it tries something else, and then dog falls down. And it's upset. And the mother keeps saying, "No, son, you need to stay in school." And so the chipmunk goes to kindergarten and first grade and second grade and third grade and gets better and better and able to do things, but then it keeps dull. And Ajahn Chah was sitting in the chair and I was sitting below him. And when he would say dull, it's like his eyes would kind of go like that. And the chipmunk would be upset. But he would keep going to school. Now he had this chipmunk going to fifth grade, sixth grade, high school. He had this chipmunk going to college somewhere, I don't know where, maybe college or something. I started laughing. I rolled on the floor of his hut, just rolling around, holding my belly. And then he kept talking. And then he heard this chipmunk get a PhD. Chipmunk get a PhD. And then I was finally able to sit up. And then Ajahn Chah just kind of looked me in the eye and just said, "And one day that chipmunk could do everything its mother could do. It could go around the tree effortlessly." And that was very beautiful. I felt very warm. That he, you know, encouraged me that we can do it. You will do it. Because our true nature is to do it. These old habits wear away. And little by little, if we do go to school, the school in this case is the practice, to keep doing these practices that we've been doing. That we'll be able to be at ease. And then he told this other story that I couldn't really figure out. Why did he tell me this other story? And so these last few years I've been telling the other story. I used to just never tell the second story. Because then he said, "You also remind me of a donkey." I like that first story because then you could do everything the mother could do. And that relates to this theme of patience tonight. And to keep studying and to go on retreats and to practice and to be patient with ourselves. But like I say, I'm in the donkey phase. Right? He also said, "Kisara, you remind me of a donkey." And Babakwa said, "Well, I didn't get to savor the chipmunk story too long before he says, 'You remind me of a donkey.'" And he said, "Now this donkey was an unusual donkey. It listened to the music of the insects at night, the crickets. You know the crickets? Crickets, lovely music. So this donkey, why not? It decided it wanted to make music. And so again, this is an unusual donkey. It investigated and it decided to find out how the crickets did it. So they watched. This donkey watched and noticed that the crickets ate dewdrops. Dewdrops, little drops of water. This donkey watched that. So then the donkey thought, I can do that. So the donkey went around licking dewdrops. Licking this dewdrop. Licking this dewdrop. Licking this dewdrop. And licked a lot of dewdrops. And then prepared itself to listen to music. And it opened its mouth and we all know what happened. Now why did he tell me that story? And again, I like that. Tanisra's encouraged me to bring that story out of the closet. over the years, now I really appreciate the two together. You know, it's important to have teachers. It's important to study, to learn, to practice, to be inspired by our teacher, the examples of the Buddha, the examples of our teachers, and we practice, and if we're patient, where accomplishment happens. But this other story that I'm just getting a feeling for is it's not just a matter of trying to copy our teacher. There's something about, and especially in our culture, there's something about how we don't honor ourselves. Oftentimes we don't like ourselves. We don't appreciate ourselves. We don't appreciate our own sound. And we often so much look over there and look over there and judge ourselves so harshly. And yes, we learn from teachers. We learn from others. But there's something about learning to be what we are and to trust the beauty of that unfolds when we give the environment of kindness, the environment of awareness, the environment of all that we're doing, then allows our true sound of what we are to manifest. And each of us has a unique sound. Each of us has gifts, has something that we can offer that no one else can offer in this world. Each of us has a perspective where we can make a difference, where we can respond to the beings we have connections with. But we also need to learn to trust, to be with what we are, to be with how we are, and to allow that to be transformed within awareness. Not just by copying somebody else, but by being with. I still have a long way to go in this activity, but I feel, though I talked about a disillusionment, that disillusionment has revealed a deeper inspiration, a determination to stay with the path, to keep relaxing into being with what we are, to allow this wonderful mystery to unfold. Privilege to be with you all. It's a privilege to remember my teacher. It's been a privilege to, all these years, to have the good fortune to have a good friend like Tanisra to practice with. So I wish you all continued good fortune to be in contact with the Dhamma. And may you continue to put these teachings into practice in your lives. We all know that a good feeling as our true nature blossoms for our own happiness, for the happiness of our family, our community, for the happiness of this world.